MacCast, Monday, March 18th, 2019. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, it is a packed show this week. There has been a number of big things going on, including a new Apple event we have officially announced now. I know we've been talking about it for a while, but there is an official announcement out, so we will be getting to that in this episode. We'll also talk about some new products. Yeah, we have some new hardware in the mix this week. Happened just this morning, as a matter of fact, and we will get into that and all the details there. And then follow up with some additional Mac news. We've got new Apple shows showing up for their video service, some rumors about next generation iPhone cameras, and I want to talk to you about an Apple ad. I know we don't talk about Apple ads too much on the MacCast, but a good one came out this week and I thoroughly enjoyed it. So I want to get into that, and then we're going to get into some of your feedback, specifically about Hubs and HomeKit. We'll talk about that a little bit. Got some great feedback from you on that. More options on encrypting files on your Mac. Got a question about archiving original photos out of the photo app. And also, we're going to dive into shortcuts along with a twist on the thing of the moment. We actually have a listener one this week, so that will round out this episode. Don't want to delay too much in getting into things, so we will just dive right in with the big news of the week. A couple big stories this week, starting off with the official announcement of It's Showtime, Apple's event that they're going to be having on March 25th. They sent out the official invites. It will start at 10 a.m. Pacific time at the Steve Jobs Theater on the Apple Park campus. It is going to be live streamed, so you will be able to follow along from your computer in the comfort of your own home or office or wherever you might consume Apple keynotes. And it is expected to be a services focused keynote. We're not expecting any hardware announcements at this, although there still are those AirPod updates that are looming. It's not expected to happen at this event, I don't think, but it could happen concurrently. Maybe we'll see some updates to the Apple website. But Apple is expected to focus on two new services, starting off with the Apple News service and then following up with the streaming TV service. Now, the News service is likely one that will become available after the announcement. There were some hints about it in the latest betas of iOS 12.2 and macOS 10.14.4. They referenced a magazine subscription service, and those were discovered by developer Stephen Trotton Smith, and he has been a pretty reliable source for leaks. What's expected is a new paid service inside the Apple News app that will give you access to paywalled news sites like the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and the New York Times. It's also expected to give you access to magazines, and all of this is expected to be PDF-based, at least when it comes to the magazines, and those will possibly offer some offline reading options. Don't know if the news sites will be similar, but I would expect that you still should be able to save things off and read those online. As far as what it's expected to cost, most of the rumors are expecting to see a price point around $10 a month, about $9.99. And I think that includes both the news and the magazine service, although I've heard a little bit different. Apple has had a magazine service that was based off the Texture service that they acquired, and I think that was around $10 a month. So if they throw in the news for the same price, that would be great. If it's a little bit more, I wouldn't be too surprised by that either. But of course, we will have details after the March 25th announcements. Also at this week's event, Apple is expected to show off their new TV service, and they might even give us a few little clips to take a look at some of their new shows. As a matter of fact, Apple has over a dozen video projects in the works currently, but the launch of the service is believed to be at least months away, probably going to be happening in the fall. As far as how those shows are coming along, the New York Times is reporting that at least 5 shows have finished filming. They say 6 are in the middle of production and 5 more have moved into the post-production stages. The shows they claim have wrapped are You Sleeping, starring Octavia Spencer, a space drama called For All Mankind, a thriller from M. Night Shyamalan, a comedy from the stars of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and a comedy called Dickinson, based on the poet Emily Dickinson. Even though they have this many shows in the late stages of production, though, Apple is still not expected to debut the actual shows until later this fall. As far as the video service goes, Apple is also expected to have some premium channel partners in services like HBO, Showtime, and Stars, although Netflix has confirmed that they are not part of Apple's new service, and it's not expected that Hulu will be part of the service either. Of course, we should get a lot more details about what's going on with the video service at this event, and I am looking forward to seeing what Apple has been up to, getting a little more details, finding out, is it going to be free? Is it going to be paid? Is it going to be some sort of combination of both when it comes to the subscription? We've heard rumors about all those different scenarios. So I think it's going to be fun to actually know for sure what Apple is going to do. And I do hope they actually do give details about the pricing on the service, although they could hold that off for later. I wouldn't put it past them. So we'll have to see what kind of details they divulge to us. But at least it does sound like we're going to get a little preview of some of the shows, and that should be very exciting as well. A lot of other people are getting excited about Apple's new video service, and at least one analyst thinks that Apple's new service could net the company up to 100 million subscribers by 2024, generating as much as 7 to 10 billion in new revenue. He thinks it would be possible, especially if Apple could acquire a studio to possibly beef up the amount of content that they have on the service. And he doesn't put it past Apple doing that. As a matter of fact, he thinks it almost would require Apple to do that to continue to drive and push forward the video content on the service. So stay tuned for details from that event on a future episode of the MacCast. But Apple also this week did announce the dates for another event, and that is Worldwide Developer Conference. It is going to be happening officially now, June 3rd through the 7th, at the McHenry Convention Center in San Jose, California. You can register now to attend if you are in Apple's developer program. You had to be in the program as of May 14th, and the tickets will be on sale, or the registrations will be going through the 20th, although it is still a lottery system. So you have to say, hey, I want to buy a ticket, and if you win the lottery, you'll be able to plunk down your about $1,500 US to attend the event. And they have to do that because so many developers want to go that they just don't have enough space to take everyone. So they've been doing that lottery system for a few years. But if you are planning on going, June 3rd through the 7th are your dates officially. And that's the latest on what's happening with Apple events. Great news this week also, if you are an iPad fan, that is because there are 2 new models available to buy. Yep, they're here. The iPad Air has been updated and redesigned with a new thinner design and a 10.5-inch display, along with an Apple A12 Bionic chip. So nice bump up there. It's also getting a True Tone display with a resolution of 2,224 pixels by 1,668 pixels. It comes in 64GB and 256GB options. It still uses Touch ID, has a lightning connector and a headphone jack. So they didn't update it to the new design with Face ID or the True Depth camera system, but the prices do still start at just $499 US for the new model, and there's a new smart keyboard sized for the iPad Air. So a nice bump up in specs and a great new buying choice if you are a fan of the iPad Air. There was also an update for you fans of the iPad Mini, and I know there are a lot of you out there. That model had been getting super long in the tooth, so this was a really nice addition to see Apple add to the lineup. It is pretty much the same all the way around when it comes to the design, 7.9-inch display, Touch ID, headphone jack, all those sorts of things, but it does also come with a few nice feature updates under the hood and one or two in the camera system. You get an A12 chip, which is a huge step up in processing power. It also, like the iPad Air, comes in 64GB and 256GB storage options, but the camera system has been nicely upgraded. It has the same 8-megapixel rear camera and the same 7-megapixel FaceTime HD camera that can be found in the new iPad Air. And as far as the price point, guess what? That stays the same as the fourth generation iPad Mini, which Apple was selling until this week. Prices are starting at just $399 US for the 64GB model. And there is one more bit of news related to these new iPads. They both have support for Apple's first generation Apple Pencil and also the Logitech Crayon. So if you want to use a pencil with your new iPad Mini, yep, it is finally supported. So I know that's another big addition a lot of people had been hoping for. It does mean that the fourth generation iPad Mini is no longer available for sale, and also the new 10.5-inch iPad Air seemingly replaces the 10.5-inch iPad Pro, because that has been removed from Apple's website as well. It is worth noting that the Air isn't a exact one-to-one replacement for the 10.5-inch iPad Pro, because the Air does not have the 120Hz refresh rate ProMotion display that the Pro model had, nor does it have the quad speaker array. It just has stereo speakers. So slight difference, but it is still, I think, a really good update. And I do think it does make sense to kind of separate the iPad Air line from the iPad Pro line and kind of clean up the bottom end of the iPad Pro line as well. So Apple kind of killing two birds with one stone in my mind. And I think now they have a nice complement, a very nice lineup, starting with the iPad at $329, moving to the iPad Mini and the new iPad Air kind of in the mid-range, and then you have your iPad Pros on the top end. So I think that rounds out the iPad lineup quite nicely, and I think it clears up some of the buying confusion as to where to jump into iPad, right? There's kind of a clear delineation now, and I think it was a little bit muddied before, but seems a little bit cleaner to me. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. What do you think? What do you think about these new updates? I'm pretty excited about them. They're not models that I'm in the market for currently, but I know a lot of you out there are. So if you do pick up a new iPad Air or iPad Mini and want to throw us a quick listener review, I welcome those. Send those audio comments and reviews to maccast@gmail.com. And then one bit of hardware that we are expecting to get an update to that I mentioned earlier that we haven't seen or heard from yet is, of course, the updates to the AirPods, AirPod Generation 2. Also, we're still waiting on the Air Power Mat and the AirPod wireless charging case. Those may happen during this March 25th announcement. Like I said, could happen quietly. I don't expect them to be in a separate event, but we'll have to wait and see what goes on there. Certainly the AirPods have been extremely popular, and Counterpoint Research this week estimated that in 2018, Apple actually sold about 35 million AirPods, and consumers rated the AirPods tops for comfort and fit, as well as ease of use. But I think not surprisingly, only about 41% of those surveyed said they chose AirPods for the sound quality. So, AirPods very popular because they are just awesome. They fit well, they work really well, and hey, the sound's not too bad either. And I certainly think if Apple were to update the AirPods, those huge numbers for AirPod sales, and their popularity would just continue to rise. So let's hope that we have some new AirPods in the works soon, because actually the batteries in mine are getting a little long in the tooth, and rather than replace the batteries for $49 each, I'm thinking I just want to buy a new set of AirPods, right? And so they can't come soon enough if you ask me. But what do you think? Are you excited about new AirPods? I mentioned earlier that I'm getting pretty excited about Apple's new TV and video service, and one of the reasons I'm super excited about it is just the quality of content that Apple seems to be signing up. The kinds of talent and shows and just the storylines and the things that we're hearing about it have gotten me very excited about the service, because I think it's top quality. I've talked about a lot of this on the show in the past, but this week I got even more excited because Variety is reporting that Taika Waititi, known for his work on Thor Ragnarok, is actually going to sign on to do the Time Bandits TV series for Apple. This is a series adaptation of the 80s film by the same name from Terry Gilliam from Monty Python. And I loved Time Bandits as a kid, the movie. I actually still love it. I watch it quite frequently. And so I am super excited about this series. I loved Thor Ragnarok. I think Taika Waititi is an amazing director and very talented. And I think him teaming up with Terry Gilliam to do Time Bandits for Apple is going to be just amazing. So I'm super excited to see that. Maybe we'll get a clip of that in at Apple's event. That would be really, really cool. But Apple continues to sign on other series and partner with other great, talented companies to bring more video content to their service. This week, we also heard about RTL Group, which is the largest broadcasting and production company in Europe. They're confirmed to be in talks with Apple about video content. RTL Group actually owns the company that produces a number of reality series and game shows here in the U.S., things like American Idol, America's Got Talent, The Price is Right, and The Family Feud. They also have shows like American Gods and My Brilliant Friend. So again, pretty great quality content, a lot of very popular shows that Apple could be partnering with them either to bring that content or new original content produced just for Apple to their video service. And then finally, another series order that we heard about this week is something called Pachinko. It's a drama based on the best-selling novel of the same name. That's written by Min Jin Lee, and it chronicles the lives of four generations of a poor Korean immigrant family as they migrate to and establish a life in Japan. So very interesting, and I'm sure great news for fans of that book. But again, here's just another example of some great quality content and shows and great partnerships that Apple is putting together for their video service. So it's shaping up to be something really amazing. And again, I'm looking forward to hearing more about it this week. Another thing we heard about this week is the potential updates to the next generation iPhone camera. Maca Takara is pointing to information from suppliers in China, and they say that Apple is working on a new triple lens camera system for future iPhones. And yes, we've heard this rumor before from other reliable sources. This is just more evidence that it is likely happening. We also saw some sort of mocked up images of what this might look like in the Maca Takara piece. And it is the camera bump square, what I'm calling kind of the Ritz camera cracker, or Ritz camera. Yeah, little merging of those two things. Yeah, I think I'm funny, but I'm probably really not. You can tell me as much. But the camera bump is square with the three cameras and the True Tone flash arranged, at least in this latest leak, like the pips on the number four of a six-sided die. So symmetrical, four little dots on a little square camera bump. I'm not so sure how much I like the design aesthetic of it. We've seen triple lens camera systems in other phones, and it tends to be just like a long bar with the three cameras horizontally aligned. Apple going for more of this square configuration, at least if the leaks are to be believed. And there were original leaks of the new lens system stating that it might be limited to just the next generation of the iPhone XS Max, but at least this one now from Makatakara says there is a, quote, high probability that the camera system, the triple N system, will be in both phone updates. So both the updates to the iPhone XS and the XS Max. So that's good news if that turns out to be true. The extra lens is there in addition to just providing another camera lens, probably with a different focal length or aspect ratio or field of view, rather. It should also improve 3D and depth sensing, giving us more imaging options and more functionality, along with improved augmented reality features. So a lot of big benefits to having a new camera system in the next generation of iPhone. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about what else we can expect from iPhone this year in future episodes of the MacCast. Those leaks are going to start coming fast and furious now that we're kind of getting through the spring announcements with Apple's event coming up. So stay tuned for all of that. Last thing that I want to mention in the news for this week is actually something I normally don't mention on the MacCast, and that is Apple advertising. They bring out television ads all the time, and a lot of them are very well done. A lot of them are clever. But this week, I found one particularly clever and funny, and it is a new ad focused on iPhone privacy. And what they're doing in the ad is trying to connect privacy with several real world scenarios. So they'll show, you know, a man walking into a restroom and not getting too close to the other man at the urinal, those kinds of things, right? And basically what they're trying to show is that we tend to protect our privacy in the real world. You know, someone comes up behind you at the ATM, you get a little bit uncomfortable. You might hide the PIN number on the PIN pad. So in the real world, we protect our privacy and we're pretty adamant about it. If someone moves into your personal space, you're going to move away, right? So the gist of the ad is why wouldn't you do that with the data on your phones? And I think it's a great new ad. You can find it on Apple's YouTube channel. I'm sure it's up somewhere on Apple's website as well. If you haven't caught that this week, catch it. They actually put out a bunch of these ads, but I think the one on privacy is particularly clever, and I really did enjoy it. So wanted to mention that to you just in case you missed it this week. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a couple of show sponsors, starting with Hair Club. Hey, look, your confidence is important, and sometimes one change can make all the difference. Hair Club knows this, and that's why they're inviting you to become part of the Hair Club family, to see how getting the most out of your hair can actually change your life. They understand the emotions you're feeling and the questions you have, and that's why Hair Club is the leader in total hair solutions with a legacy of success for over 40 years. Whether you're looking to revitalize the growth of your own hair or learn more about the latest proven methods for hair replacement or restoration, Hair Club's professionally trained stylists, healthcare experts, and consultants will craft a personalized solution to ensure you feel your best and get the most out of your hair. You know, my dad was worried about hair loss, and it was something that he struggled with. And I think if he had options like Hair Club, he probably would have taken advantage of them, because he tried all kinds of crazy things, like standing on his head to increase blood flow to his scalp. With Hair Club, I think he would have been able to rely on a little bit more real and proven solutions. If you want to find out more, go to hairclub.com/MacCast today for a free hair analysis and a free take-home hair care kit, all valued over $300. That's hairclub.com/MacCast for a free hair analysis and a free hair care kit. hairclub.com/MacCast, and a big thank you to Hair Club for their support of the show. I'd also like to take a moment to thank ExpressVPN for their support of the podcast. You know, I think we have to admit to ourselves, cybercrime, it's not something we think about too often. Or if we do, we think maybe that's something that happens to other people. Or I've often heard people say to me, no one wants my data. Like, what are they going to do with that? Can hackers really grab my passwords or credit card details without me knowing? Yeah, that's something that actually can happen. Stealing your data on unprotected public Wi-Fi networks, that's probably one of the simplest and cheapest ways for hackers to actually make money. And so when you leave your internet connection unencrypted, you're potentially opening yourself up to hacks or having your personal data stolen, and that could mean things like passwords or credit card numbers. That's why when I'm using any public Wi-Fi that I'm concerned about or not in control of, like say at an airport or a coffee shop, a restaurant or a hotel, more and more I've been turning on and using ExpressVPN. And one of the reasons I really like it is because they make it super easy. Little item in the menu bar, one click, and I am protected. And once it's on, I don't even notice it because it is fast. It's just like it's not even there. And I have the safety and security now knowing that ExpressVPN is securing and anonymizing my internet browsing. They encrypt the data and they hide my public IP address. And plus, while using ExpressVPN, I can safely surf on public Wi-Fi knowing that I'm not being snooped on or having my personal data stolen. And best of all, it's affordable. You can start protecting yourself with ExpressVPN for less than $7 a month, and it comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose by giving it a try. Plus, ExpressVPN is rated the number one VPN service by TechRadar. So start protecting your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/maccast. That's expressvpn.com/maccast for 3 months free with a 1-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/maccast to learn more, and a big thank you to ExpressVPN for their support of the show. If you heard the last episode of the MacCast, you probably heard that my thing of the moment last week was the iDevices dimmer switch. And the reason that I was picking it as my thing of the week was I mentioned that I was ditching my old Insteon system, and more specifically, getting rid of the hubs in my HomeKit setup. I have not been a big fan of hubs. I was pretty adamant on that episode about my hatred for hubs, as a matter of fact. And after that episode, I got a lot of feedback. Many of you agreed that hubs are kind of a big pain point. But still, I got some hub defenders out there in our community, specifically our friend Robert, who actually knows a bit about this stuff. He has a business doing home automation, and he agreed with me that my decision to dump Insteon was really good, but he said the choices between hub and hubless options are a little bit more nuanced than I sort of let on. And Robert, I can't agree more. I probably was very biased in my opinion, and largely based on my experience with Insteon. And Robert did point out that Insteon started out, they were a pretty decent solution, but just over time, they got buggier and buggier, didn't really do a good job supporting the products. And generally in his community, they're not looked on all that favorably anymore. They were kind of a big player, but I think they've lost a lot of favor by making some bad choices. But that said, Robert pointed out there are still some good hub products on the market, and we really shouldn't write off all hubs just because of a bad experience with just one brand. And so I wanted to share his opinion on that because I think that is fair. But still, many of you, as I said, did write in to share your bad experiences with hubs, and I actually heard about issues with several brands. I don't want to call out any of those brands. I think people who have dealt with them probably know what they are, but I do want to point out that I did get support from our community from more than one person about a good hub system, and that is the one from Lutron, the Lutron Cassetta line. And I actually think my friend Kelly Gaumont over at the Mac Observer has a Lutron setup, and she really enjoys it. I had asked her about that in the past, and that was one I did consider when I was looking to replace my Insteon system. I almost went for it. One of the nicer things about that is once you have the hub, some of the individual units are a little less expensive, and I will tell you that is the big downside about going with a lot of the hubless wireless options, things like the LifeX bulbs that I use, and also the iDevices switches. And I did mention that in the last episode of the MacCast. They tend to be a little bit pricier, but they just work. I mean, I have had no issues with my iDevices. We're now a full week into it, and they respond quickly and easily. I have had no problems with them, and I heard a lot of similar reports from others of you in the community who have also used iDevices products. The one other thing I didn't mention in the last episode that I found out since is that, unfortunately, iDevices, it looks like they're currently only available in the U.S., or at least not in the UK, and I know we have a lot of UK listeners out there. They did respond to a tweet that I saw on my feed to one of the MacCast listeners and said, yep, we're not planning on rolling out into the UK anytime soon. So that was unfortunate to hear, but if you are in the US and you're looking for a great hubless HomeKit option, a bunch of different options, check out iDevices, and they do have some products in the lineup that are a little more aggressively priced, specifically a lot of their plug-in stuff. And they also have a little $40 adapter that will take any standard light and convert it into a smart light. So this is a great option for lamps and those sorts of things. So I would say go over and check out their full product line over at iDevices.com. But another thing we did get as a little bit of follow-up was a question, not only about iDevices, but just about Internet of Things devices in general. And here is what Eric wanted to know.
Hi, Adam. This is Eric from Silicon Valley. Thank you for the review of the iDevices units you got recently. One question I have, which comes up with IoT devices, is their security, and specifically how their security is updated. Do these iDevices have an easy way to update the firmware and check to see if there is an update? Or do they perhaps do an auto update? So if you could comment on that, that would be great. Thank you very much. Thank you also for the MacCast. It's a great show. Listen every episode and have been doing so for years and years. Please keep it up. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Hey, Eric. So the quick answer to the does it have firmware or software updates, yes, it absolutely does. You can update the devices through the app. As a matter of fact, the minute I set up my switches, that was the very first thing that it did, is it said there's an update available and please download it. So I don't know if it does an auto update. Actually, I don't think it does, but don't quote me on that. I'd have to go back and check. I probably should have checked before this podcast. I will say that just in general, security in Internet of Things devices, yeah, that can be a little bit dicey, specifically depending upon the product. So I thought we'd talk a little bit more just about security in general when it comes to home automation and devices. I am definitely not an expert in the subject, but I have a feeling there's probably some folks in our community who are, and they can maybe back me up with a bit more details. But I thought we could talk at a really high level just about my thoughts about security as it relates to devices. And I think there are several things to think about. One would be, what is the risk of the device in question? And this one's really, I think, very subjective. It's very personal, right? Because it gets into probably more privacy than security, right? What are you worried about if someone were to get access to an Internet Things device on your network? What can they do with it? Can they just control it? Can they reach out and maybe control other parts of the network? Is it a potential endpoint for other attacks? Can they run malware on that thing to attack other parts of your network? A lot of these sorts of questions. And for certain devices that are maybe a little simpler, it might not be such a big problem. I'm thinking about things like lights or window shades. If those get hacked and they start messing with those things, like turning on and off your lights or opening and closing your window shades, well, I guess opening and closing your window shades, right? That could be a privacy thing, but relatively benign. Yeah, really pretty annoying and probably not something you want to have happen, but is it really a huge security problem? Maybe, maybe not. Again, all depending upon your perspective. Now, if they were to hack something like your garage door opener or your door locks, that's a pretty big deal. Or how about security cameras? Yeah, that's really, really bad. That's the kind of stuff you want to make sure is really locked down and secure. So those would be the bigger products that I worry about. But in general, I think it's good to worry about all of your Internet of Things devices because, yeah, they could be potential attack vectors for other sorts of hacks and stuff like that. So it's for sure something we need to think about. Definitely one of the best ways to keep yourself protected, as you already mentioned, is to make sure that you're updating the software frequently, that if the vendor does push out software updates, you can do that. And when you're buying devices, yeah, making sure that you pick something that is software updatable. There are a lot of devices out on the market that aren't, and they'll ship with embedded operating systems or embedded software that can't be updated. And if that software has security holes or flaws in it, guess what? The only way to fix it is to replace the entire device. So that can end up being costly. And so certainly something you want to think about when you're looking at which products to buy. You also need to look at the manufacturer of those devices. Do you trust them? Do you think they are a reliable company? Are they going to be around for a while? Are they going to be there to push out those software updates for your products? All of these things are certainly things to consider when you're thinking about buying products. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of times price factors into that, right? If you're buying the cheapest device on the market, it probably doesn't have as good security. I'm not going to say universally, but it's more likely not to have as much thought put into security or updating the firmware or having robust hardware versus a device that maybe costs a little bit more. So all of these things are things to consider when you're looking for products in this space. Another thing that is a personal choice that I've made is to only use devices and products that support HomeKit. And one of the reasons behind that is security. I know that depending upon the device and again the manufacturer, security is something that may or may not be implemented. But the thing about HomeKit and the HomeKit specification is that it requires encryption be enabled. And I guess this is more of a privacy, a sort of anti-snooping sort of measure, more so than, hey, it can't be hacked kind of measure. But it is important, right, that the traffic that is moving across the network or going, more importantly, across the internet, all of that is encrypted. You can't be snooped on. It doesn't know what devices you're controlling or what you're doing with those devices if someone is snooping in on your network or trying to do that. So HomeKit does require that everything in the HomeKit ecosystem uses encryption and uses strong encryption. That's part of the specification. In the early days, Apple actually was requiring you have hardware on your products. They loosened that up a little bit, and vendors are now allowed to do it in software. But again, that's going to prevent snooping on your traffic, and I think that is ultimately a good thing. The other thing about HomeKit is more less of a security thing, but more of a convenience thing. I guess in a way it is kind of a security thing if you care about what kind of networks your traffic is going through and who your devices are phoning home to and connecting to. That's because HomeKit devices are set up to work with HomeKit hubs. And HomeKit hubs are things like your Apple TV, your iPad, or your HomePod. And this is so you can control your devices through the internet. So when you're on your home network, of course, that stays on your home Wi-Fi, going through your routers and things like that. But if you are controlling devices through the internet, right, you need a way to communicate back to those devices. Now, a lot of third-party devices, they go through their own services or their own apps or their own clouds. With HomeKit devices, you can have all of that go through iCloud and your HomeKit hubs, your Apple products connected to your home network. And therefore, you kind of have more end-to-end control from your Apple device to your iCloud to your home. And that is really great. The other convenience part of this is that you, for all your HomeKit devices, don't necessarily have to use the third-party app or the third-party service. You can set up everything through the Home app and control everything through the Home app and through Apple's ecosystem. And that is something that I really appreciate, not only for the fact that it centralizes everything under one ecosystem, regardless of which product I buy, as long as it's HomeKit compatible, I know that I'm going to be controlling everything through the Home app, through one space, and I don't have to have all these third-party apps installed on my iOS devices and my system. Now, I think in some cases, I've found initial setup requires a third-party app, but I think even there, that's probably not 100% a necessity. I'll need to play around with it a little bit more. I think you can set up everything through the home app, but oftentimes it's just easier to go through the setup wizard with the third-party app. But once I've done that, I've generally found that I end up deleting that app or just not using it and doing everything through the home app and through Siri. And I really do enjoy that. And like I said, I think that brings along with it a little bit more privacy, at least when it comes to where you're sending your data and the networks that your data is actually going through. So those are a few things. I'm sure other members of the community will jump in and comment on this. And particularly if you're a security expert and you know a little bit more about how HomeKit specifically does security, or just in general how Internet of Things devices, other devices that are outside the Apple ecosystem compare to HomeKit as far as security goes, I'd love to hear those thoughts and opinions. Shoot me an email or an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. And speaking a little bit more about security and privacy, another thing we were talking about on the last episode of the MacCast is we had a listener question about encryption and not doing just whole disk encryption, something like File Vault 2, which we've talked about a lot on the MacCast. He was specifically asking about ways to just encrypt individual files or folders on his operating system. And I talked about a couple of solutions, software like Hider 2 from MacPaw. We also talked about sparse bundles, which you can build with disk utility on your Mac, and we talked about software like VeraCrypt, which was formerly TrueCrypt. And one of the disadvantages of that software was it was a bit complex and hard to use. Well, Daniel wrote in to say he had another option he had been using, which was WinZip. Yes, you can get WinZip for the Mac, and you can even get it for iOS now, at least according to Daniel. I did do a little research on this. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. They definitely have it available. He did concede, at least Daniel conceded, that the user interface is a little bit clunky, actually kind of horrible, quote, I think was what he said, but it does get the job done, and it is an option. And with the iOS app, I would assume it gives you the ability to go into like the Files app or the Documents app, access that stuff, those encrypted WinZip files, and then unzip them and use them on your iOS device. Because as Daniel pointed out, another challenge of encrypting files locally is how do you sync them through the cloud and then have access to them on your iOS devices. So this might be an option if you're looking to do something like that. Using the sparse bundle trick, I do sync those encrypted bundles up to some of my online backup places like Backblaze, and I could access those encrypted bundles, but I'm not going to be able to decrypt them or access that data outside of my Macs, right? I'm not going to be able to do that on iOS. So this might be another option for gaining access to that if you're doing syncing through the cloud or something like that. So thank you, Daniel, for writing in and making this suggestion. Dan also wrote in this week, and he had a question about photos, and specifically about archiving the originals from his iPhoto library. He, of course, knows that you can do this manually, right? So the idea here is you load everything into iPhoto, but you want to keep a separate archive of just the into the Photos app. I just realized I called it iPhoto, and we haven't had iPhoto for a while. So you load all your stuff into the Photos app, right? You start working with it. You have the originals in there. You can always revert to original, but maybe you want to just keep an archive of the original RAW files as they came off your iPhone or your camera, right? You want to keep those pristine, keep a archive of those. And he does know that you can actually do that manually by going into the Photos application, going to the Photos tab, selecting all of the photos. You can do a Command A to select all of them, and going under the File menu and choosing Export. Of course, if you have a large library, this is going to take a long time to do. But once you choose Export, you can choose the option to export unmodified originals for X number of items. So if you select 2,000, it'll say 2,000 items. If you select 50,000, it'll export 50,000 items. And once you choose that option, you can choose a file name and a subfolder format, and then click export. And then you choose the destination where you want to export everything to and click on export originals, and it will dump all of the originals out of your photos library and into the location destination of your choice. So that's an option and pretty straightforward to do straight out of the Photos app. Another option is you can dig into the Photos library if you know a little trick. So you can actually go into your Pictures folder inside your home folder, and if you control click or right click on the photos.photos library or any .photos library file and choose Show Package Contents, that package is really just like a folder, and you can dig in there and look for and locate the Masters folder. It's also the Originals folder, although I think Originals is now an alias just pointing to the Masters folder, and that is where all your master images are stored. So you could copy that entire folder out. If you want to drill in deeper, you can see that the folders inside there are organized by year, month, and day if you're trying to get down to the individual photos. And then when you get down to the day level, there is a folder with the year, month, day, hours, minutes, seconds for each import that you did on that day. And so within that, then you'll find the original files. And very often they just have the camera names on them. So, you know, it's not very useful or helpful to kind of dig into this folder structure, but it is there and you can access it, again, if you know how to do it, and you should know now because I just told you how. So you can do it that way, right? But Dan, really, he was looking for something that was a bit more automated. Basically, what he wants is anytime a new file is added to the library, either directly through an import on his Mac or maybe even coming through cloud syncing through iCloud, he wants to make a copy of the original to another external hard drive, or in his case, a network attached storage drive to keep that for safekeeping. And I figured, Dan, you probably could do something with Automator, set something up that way, sort of watching the folders that are in there inside the iPhoto library package. But I think another good option would be to use a software application like Hazel from Noodlesoft. If you don't know Hazel, Hazel is an app for automatically organizing folders and files on your Mac. It can sit there and watch folders and files and locations, and it can do stuff when there are changes to those folders or files or certain events happen and stuff like that. It can basically manipulate those files and then organize them for you. It can even do things like add tags, rename files. It can sort, move, copy them, and a whole lot more. And it does have support for Photos and iTunes for importing. So for on imports, you can actually get notifications and you can integrate with Apple scripts and do Automator actions and all sorts of things with Hazel. And I know it's something that my friend Dave Sparks, Mac Sparky, really likes and enjoys. I think he's done a number of tutorials and has articles and stuff on his website at macsparky.com all about using Hazel. So you might want to search over there and see what he has if you want to learn a little bit more about it. But in this case, I think you can actually build a Hazel script. And I actually know you can do this because I tried it myself to watch that Masters folder inside the photos.photo library package and watch it for changes and then copy those new files out to a new location. So in my case, when I set up Hazel, I told it to watch that folder. Anytime a file came in that was created in the last 5 minutes, so I was, you know, looking at the created at timestamp, I told Hazel, hey, copy this to a new location. And not only that, when you copy it to the new location, I set the options to ignore duplicates, meaning that if it already copied that file, it's not going to put another copy on there, right? And there's also an option to to retain the original subfolder structure of the thing that you're copying over. So when you're, you know, way deep down in that organizational structure inside the masters folder, you can copy all of that over if you want by setting an option inside Hazel. So I set all of this up, tried it out, and it did seem to work beautifully. So I think that might be another option to kind of automate this process of archiving your originals out of your photo library. So give that a shot. Take a look at Hazel. I think it's a great application. And what's great about apps like this is I think you'll find other uses for it moving forward. Like once you have a copy of it, you're going to find all kinds of ways you want to automate moving files and folders and stuff around your system. And it's great for doing cleanups and kind of watching your downloads folder. So I know one popular option is, hey, anything in the downloads folder, right, that's older than a certain number of months or days or whatever, hey, move that to the trash and get it out of here, or move it to another folder. Or maybe you have PDFs, and anytime you download a PDF, you want them to go into your documents folder into a PDFs folder. You could set up that kind of automation with Hazel. So it is a cool little application. Check it out at noodlesoft.com. And again, thank you, Dan, for your question. And further speaking about automation, something that I talked about last time on the MacCast was the iOS app Shortcuts. And specifically, we were talking about a couple different websites where you could find shortcut galleries. So if you don't want to write your own shortcuts for iOS, these are places you can go and you can simply download shortcuts that other people have set up and shared through these various galleries. Apple actually has made it pretty easy to share any shortcuts that you create on iOS. And I also mentioned that one of the best ways to learn about maybe making your own shortcuts would be to grab something from one of those galleries, just open it up and kind of peruse through it. Take a look at it, see what makes it tick, see if you can figure out how it's built, how it's connected together. And I think it's pretty straightforward when you go in and look at it, but several of you emailed in and asked if I could actually give some additional starter tips on getting up and running with building your own shortcuts. And I thought that was a great idea. And so here are some things that will hopefully make using and creating shortcuts feel a little bit less daunting. And I think the number one thing is the one thing that I kind of mentioned already. Open up the application and grab an item from the gallery or something that's already in there by default and just explore around. Take a look at it. Download something interesting from the galleries that you think you might like to try out and just play around with it. Back in the Shortcuts application, you can tap on the little ellipses icon in the sort of panel or the card. I don't know. When you add a shortcut from the gallery, it kind of sets up this little card in the Shortcuts interface, and there's a little button on there that is the three little dots. And you can tap on that, and then that will take you into the recipe for the shortcut. And you'll figure out why I'm calling that a recipe in a second here. Actually, let's jump right into that, because the anatomy of a shortcut, right? One of the biggest analogies I've heard is that you should just think about it like a recipe. And the reason there is because the shortcut is your finished dish. It's the thing that you're trying to create and consume, right? But in order to get there, you need to assemble that dish out of a list of ingredients. And not only that, you need to have that list of ingredients assembled or put together in a certain order to be able to achieve the result that you're looking for. And that is a great way to look at a shortcut, right? It is a series of, or a assembly, I guess, a bunch of ingredients, different actions that you are going to assemble together in a very specific order to complete a task, right? An automation. And each step is an action with an input. It has information or data coming in, and it has an output. It has information going out of it, and you flow one thing into the other. So it's very linear, and that poses its own challenges when you start to do really complex stuff, but you can still do very complex stuff with it. The only thing I'll say there is, especially if you're a programmer like me, it tends to be verbose, meaning that you often have to use a lot of steps to maybe accomplish a very simple task, but you can do it. So don't get hung up by that, right? You got to kind of throw off some of your preconceptions about how less linear programming works. The data really flows from one step to the other, and you still have loops and you have variables and you have all these other things. But I really think the easiest way to craft a shortcut, a new shortcut, if you're starting out from scratch, is to just write out what you're trying to do in plain English. What are you trying to accomplish? And just write it out as like a little story. And so I thought the best way to kind of maybe help you figure out how to build a shortcut is just to walk you through the process of creating a simple one. So here, we'll give this a shot. See if you can follow along. You may have to pause the podcast occasionally and go back and forth. But let's try making something like a tip calculator, right? I know there's a lot of third-party apps you can get for this, so maybe this isn't the most useful one, but I figured it's one that is pretty easy to put together and something that we can build together, and just it'll show you how shortcuts work. So sticking with my recommendation on the easiest way to craft a shortcut, let's just write out in plain English what we're trying to do. So I want to make a tip calculator. What is involved? Well, I'm going to ask for the amount of the bill. I want a way to select a list of the tip percentages, and then I want to calculate the tip amount, and I want to display the tip amount. So basically, we have kind of four steps. It may have to get broken down into some sub-steps, but there you go. We've kind of laid it out just by listing it out in our head, right? Saying in plain English what we expect this shortcut to do. So to create the shortcut, here we go. Open up the shortcuts application and then just tap on the plus icon to create a new shortcut. Now you're going to kind of see a blank window, and down at the bottom is going to be a list of all the potential ingredients, all the kind of pre-built steps that we can throw into our recipe. So down there, the first thing we know we want to do is ask a question. So in the search box, type the word ask, and you should find a task or an item called ask for input. So just drag that up into the main area of the window, and then you're going to get some options for that step. So fill out the question part of it, and you might say something like, how much is your bill? So type that in, and then for the input type, change that from text to number, because we're expecting a number, right? What is the price of the check? So that's our first step. Pretty easy, right? All right, well, what's the next thing we want to do? Well, we want to have a list of options per tip percentages, right? So type in that search field, choose from menu. So we're going to want a menu of options in this case, a little kind of drop down, a list of choices, and this will provide that. So find the choose from menu item and drag that up as the next item in the series of steps. And so that will, you'll see a little line that will then connect that from the ask for input to the choose from menu. So we're going to take our input, we're going to get a number, and then we're going to prompt the user for something else. So in the prompt, you might want to say, how much do you want to tip? And then start adding items. I think there's a couple items in there by default, so you just probably want to change the value on those items. So maybe you go 10%, 15%, 18%, 20%. There's a little plus icon to add additional ones. And what you'll notice is as you're adding these items, it's also adding additional items with the percentage name or the label beneath this step. So you're getting a series of additional steps. And this one was a little bit tricky for me at first, right? I hadn't seen this before. But basically, if you get confused about any one of the steps that you're using, you can tap on the icon or the title bar for that step, and you will get a little help panel that will slide up from the bottom. So for the choose from menu, if you read the description, what's going on here makes sense. It says it presents a menu and it runs different actions based on which menu item was chosen. So each one of those little elements that's going in down there, that is going to be the thing that we want to take action on. And then whatever the results of that are, that's passed through to the output, to the next thing in your recipe. So it's going from this step to the next step. So the next thing we're going to want to do now that we have all of our options set up is we want to calculate the tip amount, right? So we're going to have to do a calculation. So back down to the search box, search for calculate, and lo and behold, there is a calculate action. Now with this action, what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to insert a bunch of them because we're going to have to calculate that tip percentage for each one of our menu options. So you're going to drag this one up and you're going to put the first one after, say, your 10% option. So between the 10 and 15% options, you're going to put a calculate task. And there you're going to set multiply as the operation. And for the operand, you're going to want to say 0.1, right? Because we're going to multiply the original input from our question, how much is your bill? And we're going to, if the person picks 10% from the menu, we're going to run the 10% action, which is multiply that amount by 0.1. And so then you're going to repeat this, adding calculation actions for each one of your menu options. So do it for 15%, 18%, and so on. You kind of get the idea. And then once you have all of those set up, then your calculations should be working. So then back to our original statement, what is the next thing that we want to do? Well, we have calculated the number. Now we're going to want to display it. And actually here, we're going to break it down into two steps because the first thing we want to do is maybe do a little bit of formatting, a little cleanup on our number. So back down to the search menu and search for format. You should find a format number step or option. Drag that up and place it right after our end menu step. So once we're done using the menu and we've figured out our calculation, we're going to pass that through to the format number. In the format number, set that to two decimal places because we're dealing with a dollar amount, right? Dollars and cents. So we want to format that into two decimal places. And then, of course, the last step we're going to want to do is display the tip amount. We're going to show what tip should we pay. And for that, we're going to use the show alert step. So you figured it out by now just in the search box. Look for show alert, drag that up as your last item, and then you have a couple of things to configure there. You can configure the title of that alert box. So I put mine as you should tip, and I even added a little dollar emoji just to give it a little flair, a little bit of fun, and then put in a dollar sign. And then here's where a really handy thing of shortcuts comes into play. You can actually grab data or information from other steps through the QuickType toolbar. So this includes setting up things like variables that you can pass data and information into. So if you want to retain it and bring it back later. But in this case, we just want to grab the results from our formatted numbers. So after you add this show alert step, you should see a little bubble in the QuickType toolbar above where you do your regular typing. And you should see a little bubble that says formatted number. That is a holder of the formatted number from the previous step. So the thing that has our two decimal places in it. You can just drag that up and put that after the dollar sign in the results message, and it will insert whatever number was calculated or brought in from that previous step. So throw that in there, and guess what? Bing, bang, boom, our shortcut is done. Now you can test it by pressing the play button at the top of the interface. It should run through. It should prompt you for, hey, how much is your bill? Then you should get a prompt for how much do you want to tip? Select the percentage. And it then should pop up an alert showing you the tip that you should pay. And if it doesn't work, then you might need to do a little bit of adjusting, and you can play around with it and tweak it and get it working. And then once you're done, The final step you're probably going to want to do is play around with a couple of settings. Specifically, you're going to want to name your shortcut. So tap on the little settings button. It looks like two little toggle buttons up in the upper right-hand corner of the shortcuts interface. Tap on that, give your shortcut a name, and then this is really cool. You can also change the icon a little bit. So you can change the color of the icon, and you can set the glyph, basically the little image that's in your icon. And of course, I picked green and a dollar sign for my shortcut because I thought that made sense, but you can customize yours however you'd like. And then also in the settings, you can set it up as a Siri shortcut. You can choose if you want to have it as a widget or show it in your share sheet, add it to your home screen. There's a bunch of options there you can play around with. But once you're all done, tap done, then tap done again, and enjoy your new shortcut. So, see, it wasn't that hard, not too difficult to do. Again, you might have to, you know, step through this section of the podcast, pause it if you need to. But I think at the end of this, you will have a pretty good idea how to build a simple shortcut from scratch. And then I'll let you loose on the world and you can show us your amazing creations and share them with us. And if you do create something really cool with shortcuts, I do want to see it. Shoot me an email, send it to me, maccast@gmail.com. And I look forward to seeing those. And then finally in the MacCast for this week, normally I give you a thing of the moment from time to time. Well, this week we have a little twist because Robert sent in his thing of the moment. Yeah, we have a listener thing of the moment. Now, unfortunately, there was a little issue with some of the audio, so I had to clip off the front part of what Robert had to say, but basically, I'll give you the gist of it. Robert owns a Apple Watch Series 0. He was thinking about upgrading to the Series 4, but when he went in and tried it out, he just really wasn't that impressed, didn't really like it, and he was looking for an alternative because his Series 0, it was giving him some pain points. He basically ran down the pain points. He was having things like delayed notifications on the watch, basically meaning he would get the notification on his phone and then about 30 seconds later get it on his watch, which defeated the purpose, right? If he was interested in a Series 4, he probably could solve that problem with the cellular data, and I know it's a little bit quicker, but he has a Series 0 and for a lot of reasons wasn't interested in upgrading to a Series 4. A few other complaints from his Series 0, battery life, man, I'm not really going all day and wanted to see something a little bit longer. Also, the delay in raising your wrist to see the time or wait to see the time. Yeah, that's something I still suffer with my current Apple Watch, my Series 2 Apple Watch. It comes on fairly quickly, but every once in a while it gets a little bit delayed, and that can be annoying. You know, you have a watch, you want to see the time, you should be able to flip it up and just see it. And also, another thing that Robert didn't particularly like was the limit in choices for Apple Watch faces. Specifically, there's a lot of faces that limit the kinds of complications that you can have, and if you want things like, you know, a big time listing and something that still has a date, that isn't always easy to do with the current watch face choices. So Robert was in the market for some alternatives, and he found something that sounds pretty great, if you ask me. So here's what Robert had to say.
So then I found a watch that I absolutely love. It's made by Huami, H-U-A-M-I, and it's called the Amazfit Bip. And unbelievably, it's under $80. So here are the things I love about it. 1 month battery life. 2, the time is always showing. So you can always just glance at your watch to see the time. You don't have to shake your wrist, go through all sorts of machinations just to see what time it is. 3, it has an e-ink backlit display. So it makes it really easy to see anything on the watch in the dark or even very bright sunshine. 4, there are thousands of watch faces and more being added by users all the time. And it's not difficult to create your own. I did that. I have now my big digital display with the time and the date. 5, notifications are instant. That's important. So it also has numerous fitness features, which I don't really use. They're not as sophisticated as the Apple Watch, of course, but the basics are there. Heartbeat and step tracking and all sorts of fitness. It's made as a fitness watch. You know, I just don't use that function much. You can see your notifications, as I said, but you can't use the watch to respond to them, although you can dismiss a call. For me, it's no big deal. I use the watch as kind of a triage to see what the notification is, and if I need to attend to it, I take my phone out. If I don't, I move on with my day. I will say occasionally the phone call notifications don't appear for some reason, but that happens with my Apple Watch too. So the best way I can describe the Amazfit Bip is that it's the rightful heir to the Pebble, but much better than the Pebble was. I highly recommend it if you don't need the ultra-sophisticated Apple Watch features. Just need an easy way to see the time and the date, to see who's calling you, to get notifications on your wrist, and to keep track of basic fitness information. And did I mention the battery lasts a month? I really love this watch, and I think it's worth the community to check it out if they're not totally all in on the Apple Watch.
Hey, Robert, I really appreciate you sending in your thing of the moment. I'm hoping more folks will follow your lead. I think our community probably knows about a lot of great products. Specifically, I like this idea of alternatives to the Apple Watch, especially if you find something that works well and integrates well with iOS. I was taking a look at the Amazfit Bip, and it's B-I-P. I had at first thought it was Fitbit, but I think they're running pretty close of copyright infringement, maybe. But I guess they stay out of it by having it be Fitbit. But the Amazfit Bip, I will link to it in the show notes at mattcast.com. It's actually a pretty stylish looking watch as well. And at that price point, yeah, I think a lot of people might be willing to give it a shot. I also, looking on the website, it looked like they have an app and that there is HealthKit integration. So if you are using it for the fitness features, I think you can have it all integrate with HealthKit, which is a nice addition as well. And that's, I guess, the key for a lot of this stuff that's third-party stuff and not Apple, right? The thing you know with an Apple Watch is that it's going to integrate and work with everything else that you have. Some of the third-party stuff, and I had a Pebble for a while, the big Achilles heel of that was its integration wasn't all that great. So I'd be curious to know a little bit more about the integration, or if there are other products out there that integrate really well, specifically watches and stuff like that. Send us your feedback. But great recommendation, Robert, and thank you for sending that in and sharing it with the MacCast community. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the show. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Smile, makers of TextExpander, PDF Pen, also TextExpander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all Smile's applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you, getting your feedback. Send your emails, your audio comments to MacCast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page by visiting facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.